When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Evidently, we have hit $33 trillion in debt. At least that's what every right-wing conservative group in the country emailing me saying, send us money so we can stop spending money. It was kind of funny. I had to laugh. I got to type. I had to give it a chuckle. You know, when you're saying, hey, we're spending too much money. Send us some money. The country's broke. You owe all this money. Send us money. It's really kind of twisted, bizarre, but it's where we are. And it got me thinking today that, you know, there's a bunch to this debt number. And look, I'm one of those people who believes you pay your bills. I've always said I'm a tax and spend liberal. I believe we tax the very wealthy and we spend it on things we need. Roads, bridges, education, healthcare, that kind of stuff. And we are doing just the opposite of what we should be doing on this front. So I sat down today and I was thinking about, you know, how did we get in my lifetime, in the years that I have had a job, how did we go from less than $1 trillion in debt to $33 trillion? How did we do this? How did we get here? Because, you know, if you listen to any of those economic gurus, when you find yourself in debt, you got to figure out what the driver was. You got to figure out what it was. How'd you get here? How did you get here? And, you know, when Reagan took office in 1981, the country was less than $1 trillion in debt. We were $998 billion in debt. And that had been fairly consistent since the end of World War II. But more importantly, what we were is debt to GDP ratio, 31%. I don't know an American who wouldn't be thrilled to be in debt, in the debt to ratio GDP ratio of 31%. Not quite sure. But we went during his term, his 8 years, he ran up nearly $2 trillion in debt, cutting taxes, Star Wars, defense spending, all kinds of stuff. Then comes H.W. Bush. In H.W. Bush's 4 years, he ran up $1.6 trillion in debt. Now remember, he ran on, trouble. I'm never going to raise taxes. And then it was, read my lips. I see how bad it is. During Clinton's 8 years, we went from $4.4 trillion to $5.8 or $1.4 trillion in increase of the debt during his 4 years. So if you're looking at this, if you're doing the score, to this point, you're looking at, you know, Reagan and Bush, $3.6 trillion, Clinton, $1.4, and then the W years come. The 8 years under W, we go $6.1 trillion deeper into debt, up to almost $12 trillion. During the Obama years, $9.7 trillion. But remember, when Obama took office, the economy had completely cratered thanks to corporate Democrats and Republicans undoing Glass-Steagall, allowing the country to collapse economically. And we had massive, massive spending needs at the beginning. So almost a little bit of a caveat for the Obama years. And then Trump comes in. We're $20.2 trillion in debt. Remember, he was going to wipe it out. He was going to pay it all off. All $20 trillion, he was going to get paid off. Not only did we not pay it off, he increased about $9.4 trillion in just 4 years. So now here we're sitting at, you know, almost $30 trillion, and then President Biden comes in, and again, another massive economic calamity thanks to a Republican and their policies, and now we're here at $33 trillion. So I came down to what's happened. You go back to Reaganomics. You know, our Reagan acolytes, you know, even, you know, the Reagan Democrats, the Reagan Revolution, you know, the people who hate working people. What they did, the transformation they made in this country's thinking, is that if we give the rich people everything that they want, eventually they'll share it. Which we know that's not true. We know that's never going to happen. We absolutely, positively, without question, know that's never going to happen. But somehow, you know, like Lucy and like Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football, we keep doing it. And you look at all of the tax cut after tax cut fetish, because this time working people, something's going to trickle down to you. And it doesn't ever really get down to us. And you look at, you know, the moment that Reagan took office, we're, you know, a 31% debt to GDP ratio, less than $1 trillion in debt. And to this point here, we're now $33 trillion in debt and 123% debt to GDP ratio. And what do we have to show for it? Well, we have to show a large billionaire class. We've got the largest billionaire class in history. We've chosen to enrich the handfuls, the shareholders, the CEO class, the, you know, the donor class, the capitalists. We have taken care of them very well, thank you very much. And it got me thinking, you know, that the guy who wrote the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but, you know, he said, you know, rich people don't pay taxes because they don't have any income. And it got me thinking through this. Because I'm looking at what's happening right now with the UAW and the strike going on at the big three. I'm looking at this and I'm saying, okay, here, we started off in the Reagan years. Those UAW jobs were the gold standard of employment in this country. You got one of those jobs, you were going to lead not just a middle class existence, but an upper middle class existence. People were jealous of those jobs. They paid good wages, had incredible benefits, had retirement security, all kinds of things. The union fought for good stuff. And Reagan firing the Patco workers and the shot heard across the boardroom and open season on unions to today, what you have are those auto worker jobs, from what I'm now finding out, are not great. They're actually fairly crummy. And the wages, especially if you're a new person in the two-tier system, really not great. So, you know, I'm looking at this strike going, you know, there's a couple of things at play here. You know, obviously the wages, hours, conditions, and obviously the future of that job and that work, that's a big part of it. But the other part for me, and this is what, you know, I think of things in historical perspective. You know, you think back to the sit-down strikes of the 30s. You think back to the Lordstown UAW strike of the 70s that fought for a social change. And you go, could this be one of those moments where, as a country, this strike is the catalyst to get us a mind change, kind of shake us awake, a little therapy from the Stockholm syndrome I think workers have been suffering for the last 40 years? Because here's the thing. What they're saying is, look, the CEO class, the people making $22, $25, $29 million a year, these are the people telling us, sorry, we can't give you a raise up to $22 an hour. Just can't do it. You know, people who their salary for 1 year is more than these people will make in a lifetime are saying, sorry, we just can't do that. We can't give you raises because we would have to, you know, share. Now, understand, over the last 10 years, the big three auto companies have made $250 billion. And where has that profit gone? Well, they've redistributed it through dividends and share to the shareholders, stock buybacks. They announced, the three of them, $5 billion in stock buybacks. This year alone, the first 6 months of this year alone, $21 billion in profit. So the question is, where does all that money go? Well, we know where it goes. It goes to the shareholders. It goes to the CEOs. It goes to the wealthy. Overwhelmingly, it goes up. There's a giant sucking sound, if I could use a Ross Perot-ism. There's a giant sucking sound, and that's money coming out of your paycheck going into generations yet to be born of the wealth class, their pockets. And right now, you've got the UAW saying, look, you know, the Sean Fain, the president, saying, this is this generation's, this is their moment. This is history calling. This is an opportunity to, well, distribute wealth the way it had once been before Ronald Reagan. Because when you stop and you think about it, 1981, the top marginal tax rate in this country for our rich people at the top was 70%. Kennedy had lowered it from 92 down to 70 in the early 60s, and Reagan took it all the way down to 28, which, boom, are you surprised? Surprise, we're going in debt because you don't have the revenue. Now they'll say, no, more revenue came in. And for a short period of time, rich people paid their taxes and then invested in certain things that generated more income. That is true. But over the long haul, what's it done? Well, it starved schools of funding. It starved the government of resources to be able to do the things that it needs to do. You know, like war. I mean, you go back to the Eisenhower years. You go back to the Truman years. You know, we had war, and we paid for them. I know we're a war society, but we actually paid for them. Not like now where it's, yeah, we'll put it on the credit card. So the question that I have is, when do we get tired of corporate America crying poverty every time workers want their share of the wealth that they create? When do we stop, you know, allowing the Mary Barras of the world to say, hey, you know, we just can't possibly pay you a reasonable wage. I know my 20 some odd million dollars can't do that. And didn't she recently say we need to get the U.S. auto workers in line with the rest of the auto workers in the country? You know, poverty wages and desperate conditions and no benefits. Yeah. So the question I have is, will we put up with it? How do you see this strike going? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the big story today is that the UAW turned down a 21% increase. And look, I don't think they should take anything this early that isn't close to the 40 that they're demanding. Because look, if the CEO class can pocket the 40% for themselves, I think workers earn much more than what they're getting. I don't like to use the word deserve because they earn it. They're the ones. And I love what Sean Fain said. You know, if the shareholders want to keep getting this kind of money, maybe they should learn how to build cars. That's a good way of putting it. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Steve on line one. Steve in Chicago. Steve, how are you?
Good. And I wanted to expand on some of the issues that you've already raised. So one, people shouldn't be under any delusion with regard to what CEOs are actually making. So sometimes we hear numbers, $10, $20, $30 million a year. A lot of times that is not the full extent of their compensation. That's what they're making officially.
Right.
unofficially, a lot of these people get all sorts of other perks. So in other words, okay, you sign on as CEO, we're going to, you know, rent you a $20 million penthouse apartment in Manhattan where you'll live. And we're going to give you a driver and a car and access to private jets. And then, of course, you know, you get to, if the stock price hits what we hope it's going to hit during your tenure, you get to buy it at today's prices down the road when it's actually gone up. But you get to pay today's prices.
Yep.
And then sell it at your discretion. So make no mistake, these people are making a lot more money than you think, because they're getting in the way of non-money in terms of compensation. A whole lot of things that you and I would otherwise have to pay for out of our salaries.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an entirely different world. So it's basically a way to avoid Uncle Sam, because you don't have to pay a tax on that kind of perk in many cases.
Yeah. But a lot of that came out, if you remember, Steve, when Jack Welch got divorced. I don't know if you saw what came out of the divorce settlement, all of the perks that he got in retirement for the rest of his life, sporting tickets to the Yankees, to the Red Sox, to hockey, to basketball, all that stuff. You multiple apartments to live in, a secretary, you know, round the clock floral service, private jet access, all just, it was obscene the amount of perks that he got.
Exactly.
On top of the enormous amount of cash. So just to prove your point, yeah, I mean, they get, well, they get lavish everything.
Yes, exactly. It's basically, you know, it's akin to, you know, not being the king any longer, but you're still considered royalty because you're taken care of in perpetuity, the sort of thing that happened in court at one time when we had monarchical rule. Beyond that, you know, we need to distinguish between the kind of debt that you accumulate as a country. You know, there's good debt and bad debt. Bad
Absolutely.
Debt is, you know, going to Las Vegas and blowing through a couple of $100,000, you know, playing craps, roulette, whatnot. Okay, good debt is borrowing a couple of $100,000 to go to medical school and ending up as a world-class anesthesiologist in 10, 15 years. So when we have gone into debt to do things like build infrastructure and invest in education and all sorts of other things, okay, that's good debt because the return on that is exponentially greater than the initial investment. And it's amazing how in the private sector that logic works perfectly well. If you invest in expanding your company, your corporation, research and development, all sorts of things, you're going to have greater market share, greater profits. But when you apply that same logic to our society, no, we can't do that sort of thing. We can't borrow money to invest in people and our institutions, which are invariably are going to trickle down to everyone. No, we can't do that. So I mean, it always amazes me how their logic applies. And the other problem is that we have this perverse incentive system whereby, in capitalism, you become the CEO of Corporation X. You have no incentive to negotiate with workers during a strike. You have no incentive to build out the research and development portions of the company or to build new factories that are in the long run going to produce more. Why? Because you're not going to be there that long. CEO tenures don't tend to be that long. And the way in which you're compensated is short term. How's our stock going to do over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, sometimes even 6 months? And then I'll be gone, and it's the next guy's concern.
Yep.
This is why there was some advantage when families owned large corporations, because they had an incentive to invest because they were leaving it to their kids and their grandkids. Today, CEOs come in, and it's just about, okay, cut the workforce where we can, push up the stock, do whatever we can to maximize what's going to make me the bottom line in terms of my compensation package, because I'm gone in a few years.
Yeah.
And that creates a huge disincentive to be as productive as we can, and that's the problem. I mean, nobody wants to be the person who's the CEO today of the big three negotiating, because, you know, if the workers do get decent contracts, the shareholders are not going to be happy with that. And that means the stock prices are going to take a hit, and that means that these CEOs, their bottom line is going to take a hit. They were hoping, you know, maybe somebody down the road would have to deal with this problem so that, you know, they would take the hit. But no, instead it's going to be the CEO. So make no mistake, these people have a vested interest in not seeing this happen.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the reality is, you know, you were talking about, you know, the CEO staying around a short period of time and then moving on. You know, Robert Nardelli popped into my head, the former CEO of Home Depot. And then when they fired him, they, because of his contract, and this is why I say every working person should have a contract, because of his contract, when they fired him, they had to pay him $210 million plus a whole bunch of perks out the door. And within, you know, months, he got the CEO gig at Chrysler, which came with a boatload of money. It's like they never lose. They're never showing the door like working people are. And they're always looking for their next gig to cash in. And you're spot on right on that.
It's failing upward. I mean, these people are just around. It could be a CEO of a terrible company that does horribly, and then they move on to another CEO package deal. And we've talked about this because it's this incestuous relationship. They sit on each other's boards, and they make sure that they take care of one another. So when you end up being CEO, you make sure that your friends are on the board of that corporation, and they vote with you. And on occasion, there is this power play in which somebody attempts to remove someone else and that sort of thing. But by and large, it's everyone taking care of everyone else and making sure their interests are served. And it's that little party of people inside, and the rest of us have our faces pressed against the window looking inside from out. And they're going to make sure that as few people are in there as possible, because in their mind, there's only so much of the pie to go around, and there's only so many people that can be at that table. And it's not the vast majority of the rest of us.
Yeah, we're not getting in the room. I'm with you, Steve. I appreciate the thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, you see, he's spot on right. I mean, this is, I wish every working person thought like this. And look, he's talking about good debt and bad debt. And as Steve was, you know, bringing this up, my mind is actually going through this $33 trillion and how some of it is really bad debt. You think about all of the bank bailouts that have happened over the years. You think about every time the capitalists crash the economy and say, sorry, working people, if you don't give us, you know, billions and trillions of dollars, you're all going to suffer. And I was going through year by year of, your market crash and savings and loan crisis and, this banking crisis. And, you've got the war in 91, you've got the war on terror, you got all of this bad spending. And this is where conservatives get me. I'm with you on, we need to stop spending badly and maybe take some of that and spend it in the right areas. You know, Eisenhower had an enormous, spending package. Roads and bridges, largest investment in public infrastructure in the country's history. Joe Biden, with the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. And that, not even close to enough. And the thing is, by not having the investment money, we're making it much more difficult on average, everyday working people. And you go, well, how does that trickle down to us? I think back to my grandparents. In the 40s and 50s, the 50s really, there was a lot of money being spent on infrastructure. Into the early 60s, a lot of money through the GI Bill being spent on homes, being spent on building communities. There were Levittown type communities all over the country. And you look now, we're not doing that kind of investment. And you wonder why, because I was reading a story earlier today that said, it's hard for people to buy homes. There's, what would they say? It's a shortage of housing and renters just can't afford to buy and all this stuff. And you go, yeah, it's because government has stopped investing in this stuff and corporate America has gotten into buying everything up. I was talking to a kid over the weekend, young guy, wants to buy his own home. And he was saying, look, I want to find a fixer-upper. And I'm going, good luck, because you're not going to find them, because the institution of flipping them, all of those people have sucked up all of those entry-level homes that you could put some sweat equity into. And he was distraught because the houses that he would want to buy are way, way out of his price range. And for a young family to try and start out, in buying that starter home, that's gone. And it's all these flippers and all these corporate investors who are buying those properties up to rent out. And our government hasn't been doing anything to move us in a better direction. We have a housing crisis in this country. And as I've said, one of the things I would love to see the Biden administration do is start building some of those communities like where my grandparents bought, where, every house looks just almost the same. There's a variation. They flip the rooms around a little bit. But, they're, 1,300 square foot bungalows and affordable, quality, good starters. That's what we should be working on. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the weekend, got a number of communications on the UAW strike. And look, I'm all in. I think this can be transformational. I have great hope that Sean Fain and the leadership is pushing in the right direction, not just to change what's going on at the big three, but potentially all across every industry as we start asking the question, why is it we're enriching the very wealthy at the expense of the person who's doing the actual work? I'm sure hoping. But over the weekend, I got an email from a guy who said he believed that the strike was Joe Biden's fault. And I agreed with him. This is Biden's fault. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, maybe how, or if it is. I'm not going to put words in his mouth. We're going to find out if this is Joe Biden's fault. That's why I've asked Mike Williams to come talk with us. Mike is a senior fellow for domestic climate at the Domestic Climate Center at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure, Rick. I always love being here.
So let's get to it. Is this Biden's fault? Did Biden do this? Are we going to see a sticker with him pointing at the strike going, I did that?
You know what's interesting, Rick? When you empower working people, when the politics actually work, when you elect the politicians who will actually work for you, and that's Joe Biden, they feel empowered to actually stand up. And so in that way, yeah, maybe it is his quote-unquote fault, or maybe he deserves some credit for creating the space so that this transformational effort that's being put forth by President Fain and the auto workers, all of the workers there, the 150,000 of them, to step up and demand what they deserve.
Yep. What they earn. I hate that word deserve. It's what they earn. They're the ones who create the wealth. They're the ones who show up and do the midnight shift. They're the ones who bleed and sweat. They're the ones who walk home with sore backs and sore muscles. They create the wealth. They earn it. They should get a bigger share of it. And that's, for me, very simple.
That's right. And the other part of this too, Rick, so actually there's two other parts of this. The first, President Biden is the most pro-union president, definitely in my lifetime and maybe in this country's history. So he's done that not just because of the legislation he's pushed, the Inflation Reduction Act, the infrastructure bill that had labor standards attached to it, but in every way he can, he's using the power of the federal government to try to lift up and support working people and specifically union workers. But then the other part of this is he is helping usher in a push towards cleaner vehicles, towards electric vehicles. And people are rightfully, perhaps especially those who work in the industry, might be concerned about that transition. But guess what? The world is moving that direction. China is building absolutely tons of cheap, crappy electric vehicles, and they're going to start dumping them on the markets. So should we do what the other guy, Trump, says and say, no, we're not going to do electric vehicles. We're going to just keep building the gas-powered cars we have for the last 100 years and just stick our heads in the sand and then just poof, lose the industry? Or are we going to do what President Biden and Congress and actually the UAW has said they support and invest in our future and make it so we have auto jobs for the next generation?
That sounds like common sense. Sounds like smart policy. Maybe if we would have done that with other industries in the past, you know, go down the line of industries that we've lost because of outsourcing or because of technological changes that then get outsourced. Had we done this kind of a just transition, and that's, I guess, the buzzword that they're using now. Had we done this now, maybe the working class wouldn't be in the condition it's in right now.
That's exactly right. And that phrase just transition, which has been maligned and in potentially a lot of ways, rightfully so. But this is our chance to do a just transition right. And the UAW is stepping up and taking control of their future and saying, you know what? We get it. Electric vehicles are part of not just our future, but our present. But we want to be the ones building them. And the people building them, they're our members. And even outside of our members, they should be making the proper, decent wages that they have earned. And you rightfully corrected me. I said the word deserve. You're right that they've earned in doing this. So electric vehicle jobs that make batteries for electric vehicles, they should be paid what other auto workers make. Mind blowing. But that's part of what the UAW is fighting for.
Yeah. And, you know, look, I've been talking about for the last couple of days, the fact that these auto worker jobs, you know, these were the gold standard of the American working class. And I've told the story, you know, 1,000 times, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the projects, the neighbor got a job at Ford, got a UAW job, and immediately their lives got better. They had food at the end of the month. Kids got bikes. They got a car, a secondhand car. They eventually moved out of the projects altogether. Their lives got incredibly better because the wages were superior. The benefits were superior. You worked your butt off, but your life got better. I'm looking at the wages now, and I was just reading them. I'm going, who, you know, that family that lived next door to me, they couldn't have done half of the things they did with the job currently, with the conditions we're seeing right now. And that's not helpful.
No. So, Rick, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I saw it earlier today. People were quoting the Henry Ford thing, you know, like the $5 a day on the line. You know, auto workers once made $5 a day. Like, yeah, that was 1920 something. Yeah. Do you know what that is today? It's like 120 or something like that. It's something like $70 an hour or something along those lines. I don't remember the math, so don't quote me on it, although we're live, so somebody will quote me on it. Regardless, they can figure out the math. It is way beyond what they're making now.
Yep.
Auto worker wages have not kept up with inflation. That's one. That's why when people get scared, like, oh, they want a 40% raise, you guess what? They haven't had one since 2007. And to save their industry, they created a second lower tier of workers who come in at a significantly lower wage, making $20 an hour or something at this point.
17, I saw, which is
17
crazy.
An hour. And in some of the battery facilities, they're making 15 an hour. That you can't support a family on wages like that. You can't. So when you're talking about a 40% wage, we're literally just catching up to where they should be, let alone what they would be if they were making the back then Henry Ford $5 a day, the wages that would make it so they can afford an F-150 Lightning. Make it so they can afford a Jeep. They can't right now on these wages.
No, look, on $17 an hour, you can't afford any of the Ford cars, any of the trucks, because I've looked at them. They are not cheap. And those prices are going somewhere. And I think I know exactly where. They're going into the CEO's pockets. They make over $22 to $29 million a year. They're going into the shareholders' pockets. A $5 billion stock buyback, I guess, this year is what the three are talking about. Plus, you know, $250 billion in profits over the last 10 years that didn't trickle down into the pockets of the people who actually created that wealth. And this, again, is where I come back to. I'm hoping that the rest of us who have been beaten for the last 40 years almost into submission, see this as an opportunity to go, hey, if they can do it, if they can win, maybe we can too. And this begins a snowball effect of people going, you know what? We can fight for better wages, hours, conditions. We can fight for the just transition.
Absolutely. And we can see this in multiple places. The Teamsters, in a very tense negotiation with UPS, they won. And they have like huge 150% increase in people looking for jobs to be Teamsters, to be UPS drivers. Amazing. No workforce shortage there. Amazing how that works, right? We see it in the writers and the actors who are worried about getting replaced by artificial intelligence, and they have every right to be, because the greedy Hollywood producers are definitely going to do that. So they're standing up and saying no. And the auto workers are standing at the precipice of probably the biggest transformation in their industry that they've ever seen, and that anybody who's worked in that industry has ever seen. And they're standing up and saying, we want to be part of that future. We're standing here and we're claiming our right as part of that future because we have built the wealth that this industry has created. So more power to them. And you're exactly right. We need more of this. We need more of this. So everybody who cares even a little bit about the success of the American economy, the success of American people, should be rooting for the auto workers here.
No, and this is where I bring this back to why every working person should care. You know, why you should do what I've been saying for the last, you know, couple of years, adopt a striker, get out there on a picket line, walk with them, bring a couple of bottles of water, a pizza, something, drop a donation into their strike fund, because their victory is, you know, that rising tide lifting all boats and will help everybody. So for me, this is that community moment. This is that solidarity moment.
Yep, exactly. Exactly right. And I'm glad you brought up CEO pay, because it's one of the things that is just drives me nuts. The claims of, oh, we're going to go bankrupt if we have to give such big bonuses. And to see the salary, the Stellantis CEO made $25 million last year. $25 million. One dude made $25 million. And we've got people on the line who are working 10 to 16 hour days making $17 an hour. What? And this is what we're fighting. It's just, it's horrifying. So yes, just again, if I'm repeating myself, you're exactly right. People should be supporting the UAW. Adopt a striker. I wholeheartedly support that, Rick. And we'll come out better after this.
You know, this is one of those moments, again, I keep coming back to this because I think it's important. We've got rich people telling working people that they're asking for too much. We've got millionaires and billionaires telling people who work for 17, 18, 19 bucks an hour that their demands are too much and that the company will go out of, they'll go broke, they'll go bankrupt. And what's interesting to me is you look how profitable they've been over the last several years. They don't seem to want to share any of that wealth. Yet, when they were in trouble, what was the first thing they did when they got in trouble?
Ask for bailouts.
Ask for bailouts and concessions from the workers. And what did they get? Massive concessions.
Yes.
You know, everyone tells me, oh, you know, the auto workers got bailed out during the Obama years. They didn't get bailed out. They got
the auto companies got bailed out. The CEOs got bailed out. And the workers stood up and they were part of the people who were bailing them out.
Yep.
They cut into their own future earnings to save the rear ends of the CEOs and the companies. So that's insane. Nobody should say the auto workers ever got bailed out. They're the ones who were bailing the water out of the sinking ship of the auto industry. Them and the Obama administration, who also should deserve credit for saving them.
Yeah, but one thing that the auto workers did get to save is their pensions. That's one of the first times, and that's what everyone's ticked off about. That's what the wealthy are ticked off about. They didn't get to steal those workers' pensions. I got to ask you this, though. You know, I remember the Obama years, and I remember Obama saying that he had comfortable shoes and he was going to get out and walk on picket lines. I didn't see him in Wisconsin. I didn't see him put those comfortable shoes on ever. I've been saying Joe Biden should borrow those shoes because they're not well used. And he should get out there and walk on the picket line because ultimately I think he's responsible in positive ways, promoting unionism and promoting the next generation of employment that they're fighting for. Any thoughts?
So it would be amazing if he showed up. He's already voiced his support in stronger words than we ever saw of a strike this big from any president. I mean, I just saw a quote from Bernie Sanders saying, President Biden has shown in his statements how strong of a supporter he is of the UAW. Him showing up in the picket line would be just an amazing show of support. He did record a video for the Amazon workers. So, I mean, you know, President Joe is there.
Yeah.
But the visual of the picket line is pretty amazing. The last day or so, he's had Vladimir Zelensky from Ukraine in town. UN General Assembly, he's meeting with President Lula, doing an event on working people with, you know, the working class hero of Brazil. So I get it. He's president. He's got quite a lot to do right now, and we need him to do that. We need him to be that president for all of us. But yeah, I mean, it would be something else, right?
See, but I see this as a moment that could really politically help him. Outside of, you know, really helping working people and setting, but politically, this could be that moment where you go, look, I hear you, I'm with you, going into those small towns that have been just eviscerated over the years as these big corporations have just abandoned, you know, place after place, you know, saying, look, we're behind you, we're going to have your back. To me, that's the messaging in that is so important.
I don't disagree, and you know what's it? I mean, because his actions back that up. And so this would be him showing up and saying, you know, I've had your back doing the work in DC, but I'm showing up here and I got your back too. It would be the full picture. It would be pretty darn cool.
Any final thoughts?
Keep fighting the good fight, Rick. This is, you know, Solidarity Summer is moving into Solidarity Fall. I hope the worker action doesn't stop. We need it. We need it to help make sure that we have a strong, clean economy for everyone. And yeah, Otherwise, that's all I got.
Heading in the right direction. That's my thought. Mike, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much. Mike Williams, he is he's a senior fellow at the Domestic Climate Center for the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. We'll get links out on social media. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1895. That was the day that Booker T. Washington delivered what came to be known as the Atlanta Compromise Speech, which outlined his vision for race relations and black labor in the South. Washington was the founder of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, a college designed to train black students for careers in teaching, farming, and other trades. Washington was invited to give an address to the Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta. It was the first time that a black man was asked to speak before a black and white Southern audience. In his speech, he urged Southern landowners and business leaders to employ black labor over European immigrants. He said, quote, "To those of the white race who look to the incoming of those of foreign birth and strange tongue and habits for the prosperity of the South, were I permitted, I would repeat what I say to my own race. Cast down your bucket where you are." He continued, "Cast it down among those people who have, without strikes and labor wars, tilled your fields, cleared your forests, built your railroads and cities, and brought forth treasures from the bowels of the earth and helped make possible this magnificent representation of the progress of the South." His speech outlined a plan for gradual black economic advancement. He declared, quote, "Agitation of questions of social equality is the extremist folly." Other black leaders, most notably W.E. Du Bois, rejected Booker T. Washington's idea of gradual advancement. Instead, Du Bois fought racial discrimination through the legal system and helped to found the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Got an email from Terry in Santa Fe. I didn't remember the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and she pointed out Robert Kiyosaki. She said, "You're welcome." And thank you, Terry. I appreciate that. She said that she met him once at a conference. Quote, "He's actually a pretty nice guy." He said in his presentation that the real reason the wealthy will continue to get richer is because they pay politicians to make laws that are beneficial to wealthy people. No, that is spot on accurate, absolute gospel truth. And amazing to me how cheap it is to buy a politician. And, you know, I had a friend who was a congressman from Illinois, and he said, "Look, no one ever bought my vote, but they bought my ear for 10 minutes at a time. So for that $2,000 donation, you get 10 or 15 minutes to use that congressman as your priest, to dump all of your wants and wishes and dreams and hopes onto, in the hopes that they fall your way. And enough of you say that, they begin thinking that way. Let's quick go to the phones. We got Harry on line one from Chicago. Harry, how are you?
I'm well. So when Jack Welch was leaving GE, there were three men vying to replace him. It was Nardelli, McNerney, and I forget the third one. But what all these corporations, they all had backup plans, corporations they were going to go to. Like McNerney, instantly, since he didn't replace Jack Welch, he went to 3M. He tripled 3M stock, if I remember correctly. And then he was pretty much done there. And then they replaced the Boeing CEO because the Boeing CEO, unfortunately, monkeyed around with one of his underlings, let's call them. But anyways, the problem is that these CEOs get these huge compensations because everyone's vying for them because they think that they need them, and to a great extent, they don't. They're hoodwinking themselves into this. And one example is like the McDonald's CEO. They're always thinking of new sandwiches to come up with. And I went to school for business administration, and my concentration was in human resource management, just a little bit of background. But when you go to the McDonald's CEO, they're always coming up with all these new products to sell. But really what they need is to fire like 10 or 20% of their managers, because you go in there and they're nasty. Okay, they're not nice to their... to the people that walk in. And the thing I came up with a couple of weeks ago is stop hating your customers, because you go in there and they treat you so poorly. So if they just kept the stores clean and the management nice and all the employees nice, that would business would be booming. But so are you still there?
Yeah, and I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you to get to the point where if you pay those people a decent wage, they'll be much happier. But go ahead.
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry, I'm on a cell phone and...
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say that if you paid them better, they'd be happier.
Who? The employees?
Yes.
Well, okay, so that's absolutely true. But what I took some of the first entrepreneurship classes and culture classes on determining the culture in a corporation. And one thing that we found out was that 90% of employees, and that may be a bit of an exaggeration, but we'll use it as a round number, they leave their jobs because they don't like their manager, not because they're underpaid or they don't like the hours or their job content, but it's because they don't like their manager, okay? So they may say that they're underpaid, but that's only one aspect of it. When you have these nasty managers, I've gone into McDonald's, and I don't go there often because they don't have salads anymore, but it's bad management that's causing McDonald's problems. Like when you go in and they don't have ice cream for days and weeks at a time. Well, McDonald's knows. They have computers. They know when the store has not sold any ice cream or any shake, and they still let that store get away with it. The zone manager lets them get away with it. They don't need these hyper-intelligent people that have been trained in Six Sigma and all these other things that they think they need. They need someone who's going to MBWE, management by wandering around, et cetera. So
no, you're right. I'm with you. Good stuff, Harry. Appreciate it, man. He's right. He's spot on. And look, you know, the reality is you've got these people who are looking for things to do, trouble to make. You don't need to recreate McDonald's. You don't need new sandwiches or anything. What you got is what that's the golden ticket, man. Do that really, really well and stick with that. So I agree with him. But, you know, here's the thing. And then it comes back down to this. You know, we end up management heavy, worker light. We pay the people at the top enormously well, and the folks at the bottom who actually do the work, they're the ones who get shortchanged. And the weirdest thing is you know, and I don't want to get all hung up on the McDonald's thing, because my experience has been, you know, it's the managers who are you know, just horribly angry and, you know, cracking the whip, and it's the workers who actually are the, you know, the people who are the lowest end of the spectrum. They're the nice people. They're the people who smile, and even though they're struggling to make ends meet, and you know that, because they're not making a decent wage, and they're taking you know what from above, and yet still they're still nice. I guess I struggle with that. But you know, on this CEO thing, this is I'm hoping we're at a juncture right now where we start looking upward. And you saw it also in the UPS strike, or the UPS talk of a strike, when they were the contract fight. They were going after that CEO who was making, you know, enormous amounts of money, and the stock buybacks that were, you know, being done to pump up the price for the CEO. I'm hoping working people are paying attention to that. Because if anything, all of these worker actions, these are what seem to be the undercurrent. And I'm hoping there's some kind of cosmic plan to move us in this direction. I'm hoping there's some way to get that message. Now, to Harry's point about about people not leaving jobs because of wages, and it's about treatment. In my years of organizing, virtually every place that we organized, it was about conditions. It was about treatment. And I think this is why you're seeing so much labor activity, like around Starbucks and around, you know, Trader Joe's and AEI and all of these different REI and all these different, lower end employers, because the treatment's crap. You came out of the pandemic being told you were a hero, you're essential, you know, all of this stuff. And then, oh, the pandemic's over. We're going back to pre-pandemic treatment. And I'm in this mindset that, you know, people have had enough of it and aren't going to put up with it. So maybe we are in this cycle where people are going to, well, not put up with the same old garbage. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Always there, always available. Share it with your friends, coworkers, people you like, people you don't like. Make sure you share it. Also, if you want to get some of the Working Class Hero merchandise, we have opened a store on thericksmithshow.com. Just go to the store. You can check out any of the clothing things that we've got, from hoodies to t-shirts and all that. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Vivek Ramaswamy, great new proposal he's got. And look, you know, understand, Republicans look at federal employees as whipping boys. It's a good whipping tool. You know, it gets the base all riled up and all bunched up in the panties because, you know, those people still have health care and a little bit of retirement and earn generally a decent wage. So, of course, we've got to destroy that. But Ramaswamy says if he becomes president in 2025, 1.5 million federal employees, they're going to get the axe. Day one, he's going to get rid of the who's who of right-wing winery. The FBI, the ATF, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Education Department, Food and Nutrition Services within the Department of Agriculture. Man, going after, everything that they believe goes after them. It's kind of like bringing back the good old days of patronage, which seems to be their wet dream. And here to share some thoughts on what this might look like and what the possibilities are, I've asked Jackie Simon to come talk with us. Jackie is the Director of Public Policy for AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do there. Jackie, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So your members, the federal government employees, Republican whipping children, Ramaswamy says we're going to dump 1.5 million of them. Can he do that?
Not really. It's extremely unlikely. Even Republicans have treated some of his claims as ridiculous, and this one, I mean, it's not an absolute impossibility, but boy, would he have to have the stars align for himself.
But what would that look like? You know, because as I was reading through these stories, I'm going, you know, why would you want to get rid of all of these different agencies? What's the goal here? And I keep coming back to privatization and profitization of the things that we do for ourselves. And for me, it comes down to the money. And I look at him as an entrepreneur saying, hey, we can privatize government.
Well, it's interesting. I haven't heard him say that he would want to continue the functions of all of those agencies, only to have them carried out by private contractors. I've heard him say that he wants to eliminate these agencies altogether and the function they perform. Because as you said, he doesn't like anything that they do. He doesn't like what the FBI does. He doesn't like what Food and Nutrition Service does. He doesn't like what the ATF does. So maybe you heard something that I hadn't heard yet, that he actually wants an ATF. He just wants it, the work of ATF carried out by private contractors. But my understanding was this idea of just pure elimination.
Right.
And, you know, he can't do that unilaterally. He needs Congress to do that, because all of these agencies are authorized to exist by law. And he can't change laws. Congress changes laws.
Well, he seems to think, the one article I read, he seems to think, because the Supreme Court is a 6-3 conservative
right.
court, that he's going to be able to do whatever he wants. And the six conservatives in robes are going to side with him.
Right. No, I mean, he says a lot of really simplistic things, but the fact of the matter is all of these agencies, all the programs of the federal government exist because Congress enacted laws that instructed the executive branch to carry out these functions. And so you've got a situation where you've got, you know, 1.5 million is, you know, almost three quarters of the entire federal workforce. So it's more, a whole lot more than the agencies that he's listed. And he seems to be saying that he thinks he can do these mass layoffs without worrying about the due process rights that civil servants have as part of their jobs when they've, you know, gotten some kind of tenure. And what he doesn't realize is that federal employees associated with those rights also have rights in the context of what we call a reduction in force. And so when he's doing his mass layoffs, you know, it really would be individual by individual, and they would consider, agencies are required to consider, you know, how long you've worked there, what kind of appointment you have, whether you're a veteran, and your performance ratings, and they have to consider all of those kind of things. But if it's not a temporary layoff, if it's a permanent kind of layoff, that, in our jargon, that in itself becomes an adverse action that triggers these rights that he thinks he's avoided.
Right.
So he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah. The reason I said that he would profitize it is, you know, the function that these do, I hear people all the time say, you know, they're job killers, and they're, you know, they're doing all this stuff. The moneyed interest would be thrilled if we got rid of half of our government, because they could do whatever they want and run roughshod over anything they want. At least that's my thought in this.
Oh, there's no doubt that you're exactly right. My only point is that he can't do it because he would be in conflict with the law. I mean, we still have some rule of law in this country. I mean, it's always dicey and threatened, but a president, any president, can't just do that without regard to Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just, you know, would he have a compliant Congress? I mean, if we got to a point where Ramaswamy could become our president, you know, the kind of an election that would elect, I don't want to call him an idiot, an irresponsible person like that. And, you know, he almost, I'm not going to say he makes.
Yeah, I mean, look, he elected Trump. I mean, and there's a possibility he could win again. So,
I know.
You know, for me, anything is possible. Because here, the reason I think this is important, and I'm with you, I don't think that Ramaswamy's going to win. I don't think he's going to be able to get rid of, you know, 1.5 million. But Trump has already said if he gets back in, he's going to grind the axe. You've got the Heritage Foundation now, who's got this Project 2025 that they're putting out on how they're going to reshape government and bring back the good old days of patronage. There's a lot of scary stuff coming.
There is, but I think I would also, you know, I'm not saying that I disagree with you. There's a lot of scary stuff already happening. More people are being hired outside the competitive service right now than are hired competitively. There's lots of accepted, what we call accepted service, you know, exceptions to the rule. The exceptions now exceed the rule in new hires. All these agencies want and get authority to just hire directly without regard to, you know, a competition. And, you know, one of the things we often say is when you make it real easy to hire like that, you have to, on the flip side, make it real easy to fire. And so the people who are hired that way have a lot fewer rights when it comes to, you know, the end of their job, whether they're term employees or temporary employees. You know, their status is not anywhere near as secure as a regular civil service, competitive service job. And the thing that gets the most attention is this Schedule F, which Trump did by executive order right at the end of his term in October, that never really got off the ground. But, you know, he's promises to do it with a vengeance, and DeSantis has taken up the Schedule F banner, Ramaswamy, and of course Heritage.
Right.
And that basically could really be the death knell of the civil service.
For those who don't know, what is Schedule F?
Schedule F, we say Schedule F for flunkies. It basically says that any job that is in any way connected to policy, the president's policy or the president's agenda, basically can be turned into a political appointment and you become an at-will employee. So you can be fired for not being sufficiently loyal to the president and his agenda.
So these are the patronage jobs that I've been talking about.
This is the patronage, like you said. And you're not hired. I mean, you know, on paper, it says you're supposed to be qualified for the job. But, you know, we all know the kind of qualifications that in the way they adhere to.
You know, like putting a guy on a federal bench who's never actually been in a courtroom.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most egregious during the end of the Trump administration, they had this guy who was, you know, 15 minutes out of college in charge of, you know, presidential personnel and appointments in the White House. I mean, it was unbelievable. And he was issuing loyalty tests. And he and his minions would go around to the agencies and observe people to make sure that they were carrying out the president's agenda. Sometimes we wish the Biden administration would follow suit.
I don't want that. I've said this before, Jackie. I don't want federal workers to be on either side. I want boring bureaucrats who know their job, do their job, and provide the American people with the best possible services, and not being political. I don't even want them to know who the president is. Just do their job instead of moving where Republicans want to take us into this loyalty oath kind of positioning.
Yeah, I hear you, and I 100% agree. I'm just really referring to the fact that President Biden issued executive orders very early in his term and instructed the agencies to treat the unions very well and bargain good contracts and treat federal employees with respect and dignity. And there's an awful lot of federal managers who say, yeah, right. Make me and ignore that kind of stuff. So it's just very different from when Trump was in power and it was yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And now that Biden is in the White House, it's kind of like, yeah, whatever. So yeah. That's what I'm referring to.
No, I hear you. And that's where I want decent people running our government. And look, at the end of this, I look at Ramaswamy, I look at Trump. The federal worker has, as I said at the beginning, become the whipping boy for, you know, the right. And, you know, listen to talk radio. It's all about, you know, how bad they are. And look, I know a lot of federal employees. I know a lot of people who work at the VA. These are good, decent, hardworking people who don't need to be used as political pawns. And it's a shame that we're in this place.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's a perennial. They love to beat up on us.
Now, here's the thing. You talk about patronage. We're talking about this. I look at the Heritage Foundation now has this Project 2025. And look, the Heritage Foundation always has, you know, some kind of scheme. But this seems like something really, you know, 30 chapters, 900 pages written by, you know, more than, you know, a couple hundred people on how to reshape government and how to get those patron employees in. In fact, they've got training programs to make sure that you're sufficiently loyal. I mean, it's really all encompassing. And with a Trump presidency, this could happen.
Yeah, they have a legal theory that they'll want to test that argues that the president is the ultimate boss of every federal employee in the executive branch. And as such, every federal employee ought to be a political appointee, answerable only to the president. And like you said before, with Ramaswamy, which is a kind of slightly different situation, you know, I think that's basically one of the legal theories that they'd like to test out with this Supreme Court, and whether civil service protections and the law that was passed in 1978 is constitutional, and whether or not by law federal employees should have any kind of rights on the job.
Well, we're tearing up the 20th century. Why not this too?
Yeah.
Lastly, I got to get your thoughts. Completely different topic. The UAW has been on strike for a couple of days. You've got thousands of people on the picket lines. Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, we're rooting for them for sure. I mean, the UAW historically has sort of set the standard for union activism, the best standard of living the working class people have ever achieved has been largely through the successful efforts of the UAW. And so, they seem to be leading the way again, and we wish them the best. I think that their arguments in favor of restoring defined benefit pensions and getting rid of this two-tier wage system and substantially higher wages, given the profitability of these companies they work for, they've got great arguments on their side. I think their membership is well-educated, and they know what they're doing, and they've got a good strategy, and I'm rooting for them. Yep. That's all I can say.
As we all should be. Jackie Simon, I appreciate you taking time for us, sharing some thoughts on these horrible ideas put forth by my Republican friends. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thanks so much, Jackie Simon. She is the policy director there at AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So let's talk destroying institutions. The American Library Association, the planet's oldest library association, almost 150 years old. They're struggling under partisan divide as Montana, Missouri, and Texas announced that they were going to sever ties with the library group. What do you think it's over? It's over. Yeah. What, you know, it is. And look, you've got the crazy people, book bannings have been happening. And now a Republican candidate for governor in Missouri, the Show Me State, showing us how crazy they are. They are promising book burnings. This candidate and a state senator took out their flamethrower and started burning some boxes and said that... in the videos, I'm taking a flamethrower to cardboard boxes representing what I'm going to do to the leftist policies and rhino corruption. But let me be clear, you bring those woke pornographic books, meaning just about any books, into Missouri schools and try to brainwash our kids, and I'll burn those two on the front lawn of the governor's mansion. Yeah, book burnings are coming back. We're going to make book burning great again. Thanks, crazy people. Let's go to the phone. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Insane. And they're all crazy, I'll tell you that. In our little hamlet, they've lost their minds. We have five council members, and four of them are Republicans. And two of them in particular have been known to scream about the war on Christmas and telling us what to do and the poor Christians and whatnot. And now they plan on this new ordinance. Now, mind you, we only have four streets proper and four side streets. We have no room to grow because we're surrounded by the river on two sides and then the township on the other two sides. But now we have to, when it snows, we have to go out and shovel the street, and I'm not joking. And if we don't do it, it's a $1,000 fine, and it's a criminal offense.
You're going to shovel the street?
I'm not kidding. I swear to you. I said I'm not shoveling no street, because let me tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to have a heart attack, and then my son's going to see you, and he's going to be a very wealthy man. They're totally insane, and their theory is, well, because they want to make our little hamlet safe and make sure they don't get sued. And I'm like, well, didn't we buy a plow truck 2 years ago? Isn't that what you guys are supposed to be doing? Isn't that like part of your job besides just making rules, telling everybody what they're supposed to do and living like you think they should? So, yeah, they've all lost their minds, all the Republicans.
Another fun story of Republican governance. Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it.
Yep.
No, this is, again, you know, one of these things, and I'm not surprised by it. Look, you know, these are the people who tell us that government's bad, government shouldn't do anything, and, you know, then they set out to prove just how bad Republican governance is. You know, the one thing that you would expect from your township or your hamlet is that they plow the snow. I mean, that used to be expected, no? Can you imagine a bunch of citizens out, you know, we're just going to, you know, with our hand shovels, go shoveling, you know, the main street coming into town? Wow. But tax cuts for rich people. So we don't have to worry about paying anyone. Or ban books so that we don't know that they used to. This is where, you know, I go back to my reading in 1984, and it's no wonder they want to ban 1984, because that book alone, that one book alone, you know, made most of my political thoughts as a young kid, you know, pretty much in stone, because we are living in that Orwellian kind of world. And I've often said, I don't know whether, you know, it was, you know, 1984 was a cautionary tale of, hey, you know, this is bad, don't do this, or if it was a playbook. I look at it as it's a cautionary tale. We should not do this. And I look at my friends on the right as, no, this is perfectly fine. This is what we should do. Yeah. Wow. I mean, just wow. A new study out finds that college-educated voters have more liberal views on economics than non-college educated folks when it comes to taxation, social safety net, income redistribution, and government intervention in the economy. And this is kind of shocking to me because, you know, I'll tell you, you know, I went through a couple of econ courses, and they get you thinking like an economist, you know, like a corporatist, like a capitalist. You know, it's these models, and these are models they're sacred, and you shall never violate them. And, you know, I would think that, you know, working class people would go, no, we want to make sure that we don't struggle and suffer. We want to make sure that, you know, food stamps are plentiful so that if we fall in hard times, we get help. That unemployment benefits are much more generous in the event that I lose my job, I don't end up losing my home. But the weird part is it's just the inverse. And this is what this study is saying, that, you know, people who are more college educated, they're more open to intervention, government intervention, and helping, you know, the economy, you know, one way or the other. They're into a social safety net because of, you know, they understand the public good. Whereas you talk to a lot of, especially the red hat wearing working class, you know, screw those people, no unemployment, no, you know, I'm there's part of me goes, they'd even be against workers' comp. I mean, we are literally shredding the 20th century. And as I've been saying, you know, they want to take us back to the good old days of the Lochner era, where if you're hungry enough and desperate enough to work in deplorable conditions for poverty wages, that's your right. It's your liberty. It's your freedom. And I go, you know, when do we shake ourselves awake and go, no. You know, again, it goes back to my high school government teacher. Which are you closest to, being rich or being poor? And the vast majority of us are closer to being poor than we are to ever being rich. Interesting times. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Remember, check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You can find our merch store. Also, podcast. If you miss any portion of the program, it's always there.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the reporting coming out of Colorado, evidently, and this is, I gotta tell you, this is dumb. I'm not on this bandwagon, and I think it's dumb. But evidently, it's being reported that Lauren Boebert could face sex crime charges under Colorado's lewdness law. Because if you saw the video, they were groping each other. She was blowing smoke and just being, you know, the kind of trailer trash that you expect that she is. Just your run-of-the-mill garden variety. But I don't know that it rises to the level of criminal. I mean, really? No, I'm not there. You know, let her be who she is. Don't martyr her. That simple. Now, interestingly enough, her husband has come out in defense, her ex-husband. Jason, who exposed himself to the world, I guess, he says that the divorce has been devastating, that I hold all responsibility for. He said it upsets me to see everyone believe she left me over fame and a new lifestyle. That's far from the truth. Much of this is on me because the problem starts at the root, and I am the root. Yeah, I don't care. I just don't. And don't. Don't bring her up on charges. That's just dumb. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top story of the day and everything else we can get to, our good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst. Bob, thanks for taking time for us. Did I lose Bob? Bob, how are you? Yeah, I think I lost Bob. Yeah, we lost Bob. But here's the thing. This is one of the weird moments where I look at this and I go, no, do not, under any circumstances, go after her like this. She got enough problems, enough craziness. Don't martyr her. Because you can see that the fundraiser, they're coming after me. Now, what's interesting to me, what really is interesting, is the boyfriend that she was with, the guy that she was all over groping, doing all that stuff with, actually owns like a bar where they do drag shows. I mean, this is the part that's hysterical. The guy owns a bar and they do drag shows at this. And she's this, you know, the family values type, the hypocrite type. But I think we got Bob back. Bob, how are you?
I did a Boebert or Marjorie Taylor Greene. I hit the Bluetooth button accidentally. That's what happened.
That explains it. So what do you think? Do you think they should charge her under the criminal code in Colorado for lewdness, or just write this up to she's just being who she is. She's just, you know,
in my news notes, because I just had to, one day out of four this happened, I put one story, Beetlejuice, 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 I put across, you know, because it was snarky. Yep. And as you know, and that was it. I didn't even put any of this because I'm like, you know, okay. I don't know how they keep her in there. She barely won the last election, but yet they won't and they can't charge her because, look, go look at concert footage, you know, or even go look at a Disney on Ice skating show. Somebody's kissing somebody probably. So, yeah, this would just absolutely, she would fight it with lawyers. She would probably win. And then, let it go. And as far as her and her ex-husband, that's their business. But you know what? He might have some entanglements, you know?
Yep.
She's in Congress. Maybe, I don't know how much money he made. Maybe he pays a little alimony, or she pays a little alimony to him. Who knows?
No, I think he makes more than she does. You know, all those sweetheart contracts he got with the oil. Oh, he was making $500,000 a year.
Even with taking his clothes off?
Yeah, wow. Well, especially after that, I guess. No, if you remember, you know, when she had to do her disclosures, he was making, like, from the one oil and gas company, you know, like for, as a consultant. He was making $500,000 a year. That wasn't patronage. That wasn't, hey, influence your wife to vote the way we need her to. That wasn't any of that. Yeah. Never mind. But,
He'll still support her in most cases because they've got entanglements, you know. And she's in Congress. He might need a favor.
Yep. Now, here's the weird thing. I was just reading a story earlier today, and because I use this thing with Boebert's husband, who, you know, there's some questions there of corporate money going into his pocket that wasn't there before she came into Congress. And I saw this story today about Kevin McCarthy's brother, who got something like, you know, $6-7 million or some kind of, you know, a huge amount of money in government contracts, claiming he was, I guess, American. Some weird thing where you go, you know, he's cashing in on the brother's name. They're impeaching, you know, Joe Biden for kind of the same thing. Doesn't this seem a bit hypocritical?
Well, I think it's frankly all hypocritical in the sense that they need to either clarify the laws. You know, when Abramoff got in trouble, then they made this big deal, and you know, he got in trouble for other things I wasn't involved with, but I got in trouble for a golf trip and the underreporting of that golf trip. Later, they're like, we're gonna drain the swamp of these trips. Go ahead on Google how many trips have occurred since I was there. Yeah. You know, just Google it. So they do this from time to time. Then they'll go out and, but you know, if they want to tighten the whole family thing, because look, if you look at this, you had the Clinton Foundation, and there was the one big question about the online chancellor appointment by Bill Clinton, et cetera, and she was Secretary of State. Trump went in the White House, taking his kids in there and letting them still conduct business. That was outrageous. And then you've got, you know, of course, you know, allegations with Hunter Biden. When I was there, I can tell you there were families that had consulting firms, and the dad, I can't even remember, honestly, whether it was Republican, Democrat, but the dad, I think that there was a Republican. There was one of each. The dads who were Congress people had authority over defense contracting, and their kids were in defense contracting firms. Yep. You know, this occurred all the time. And like I said, I don't begrudge anybody's kids to make money, but they probably need to Congress needs to kind of clarify this if they don't like it, of what you can or you can't do.
I go back to, you know, when I was a kid, you know, Jimmy Carter was in the White House, and, you know, you remember Billy Beer? I mean, you know, he was cashing in literally. You look at Reagan's kids, they cashed in. You look at,
Roger Clinton. Then, Rick, you got the relatives that you want to deny.
Roger Clinton, you know. There's one. I forgot about
there you
him.
Go. But, okay.
But this is how things have always been done. And so to say now we're going to impeach somebody because, you know, the family, you know, made money off of Biden's name. I'm sorry. Unless you can draw me that straight line where there's a quid pro quo with Biden, there's nothing here for me.
Right. Well, and that's why, you know, there used to be the Honest Services fraud law. And if they can't get you for bribery, I mean, they can get you Honest Services. If you work for a company, you go to a ball game, tell the company you were sick, you went out of state, they can get you federal charges, you know. That had a Supreme Court decision against it. So the government, if it wants, can do this wide brush. But for the bribery, they have to have some type of connection where, you know, the president did something where you've got an email and it says, hey, you better help my kid out, you know.
Yeah. I want to see that email.
Right.
But we're heading quickly towards a government shutdown. Earlier, I talked with someone from the American Federation of Government Employees about Vivek Ramaswamy's idea to fire 1.5 million employees because he wants to, you know, do mass layoffs. And she said, you just can't do that. And I'm going, my mind then went to, hold on, Republicans want to do a mass layoff. They just want to shut the government down entirely. Any thoughts on how we're going to get out of this mess?
Yeah. Well, here's the one certainty I will tell you right now is that McCarthy doesn't want a shutdown, doesn't want near a shutdown. He wants this. This one isn't some BS thing. Now, I'm not, because of the way they're doing it, because there's no Democrats involved in doing this. This, I'm calling this, instead of the shutdown, this is the CFS, Circular Firing Squad. That's what it is. It's not a shutdown. It's a Circular Firing Squad. McCarthy's got 12 people. If you count how many votes he can spare, he needs to pick up basically eight Democratic votes. Now, the way he will do that is to craft a continuing resolution that will be clean and not contain language that would, you know, make a Democratic member not like it. Now, the second thing is, if he does that, which he should do for good government, you know, we did continuing resolutions with Democratic votes. But if he does that, guess what they're going to do? They're going to move to throw him out because he, you know, cooperated with the enemy. So he's in a no-win you know, position on this thing.
And do you remember when he was going through the whole confirmation and the whole thing? And I said, I want this for him because I want this moment that he's living through right now, where the acid reflux is in his throat and he's seeing the crazy caucus in his sleep and he's waking up in the middle of the night with heartburn because they're driving him crazy. Well, this is that moment.
Well, sure it is. And the thing he did, which he should have let it gone 30 rounds instead of 15 that it went, he never should have, and no speaker should ever agree that one member sets off a cascade of, you know, take them out and have a vote. If you do government in that way, then you can get a member either side of the aisle, or somebody, when Pelosi was speaker, somebody, you know, got mad at her, they could do that every day.
Yeah.
And it rots the system. So McCarthy's got that, which he should never have done. The other thing is, and this is my personal biggest disappointment, I love the appropriation bills. I've said it for years on your show. I like doing them separate. Every item, one by one, has to be argued. People hear about it. You know, no matter what the issue is, you know, the groups put out notices. They don't do that when they do continuing resolutions. McCarthy promised, and the Freedom group wanted this to be done, and guess what? We're sitting here, and it wasn't done.
Yeah.
It simply wasn't done, and now he's sitting here with this mess, which he would have been better to have one way or the other pass the bills, but then again, he couldn't pass the bills. Yeah, well, this is catch-22, Rick. He couldn't pass the bills because the Freedom Caucus won't vote for any bill that doesn't have 900 pages of additional new language in the law.
Yeah, he's in he put himself in a jackpot.
No way.
And I love the fact that, you know, House Majority Whip Tom Emmer, Republican from Minnesota, said the patients are now in charge of the hospital. Saying, look, you know, they've lost control. The leadership has completely lost control. Everyone's eating everyone. And if you're a Democrat, you've got to just sit back and let that happen.
If you're on the Democratic side, Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, has to tell his members, look, let them go. You know, just say, hey, we're willing to be part of a functional government. We're sitting here. Give us a phone call. We're not going to get in the way. We're willing to help. You know, call us. That's all they need to do, the Democratic side. That's it. Because the Republican side is doing enough damage, and you don't want any interaction from the Democratic side except, hey, we're willing to talk about this. We're willing to keep the government going. That's all you need.
Yeah, I mean, a shutdown's all on them. And this is why I do believe McCarthy knows it's a loser for them, which is why he's got to figure something out, or, you know, he's going to be out.
Well, if they ever actually remove him, if that ever happens, the chaos that will ensue in that House will guarantee, I don't care who's running for president or who's ahead or behind in the polls, presidential level. Rick, if that ever happens, that McCarthy is thrown out by the Republicans, the ensuing chaos will guarantee the House will be democratically controlled with a few votes to spare. That's what it will guarantee.
That's why I keep saying, you know, hey, Florida, the forehead guy, go on, pull the trigger, go after him.
Oh, put him in as Speaker. How about that?
him and Marjorie, three names. Good luck. Get on that. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Nay, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. I got to get your thoughts on Vivek Ramaswamy again. He's, you know, he's stirring it up. He's the new Trump, if you will. Always getting attention. But he now says he regrets taking the two doses of the COVID vaccine that he's got. He regrets it now, Bob. Never going to do it again.
Well, you know, I mean, he said a lot of things. As you know, originally he made statements on Trump, and then he backtracked on that. And then, of course, you know, his wife Now, I think she disagreed with it. I know she did. She's a surgeon, and I think she supported getting the vaccines. I'm pretty sure.
The fun. And finally, got to get your thoughts on the Trump interview that was just it's like every time he opens his mouth, it's like Exhibit A, Your Honor. Evidently, he has now said it was his decision to challenge the election, he and he alone, and that he dismissed his lawyer's opinions because he didn't respect them and they were wrong.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to look at this, and is he trying to fall on the sword, or which I can't imagine due to narcissism? But I'm trying to figure out, making that statement legally, what does that do? What does that do on the court cases? I mean, don't you agree that there's something behind? He's not the type of guy, hey, I'm going to step up. Hey, Rudy. He calls Rudy on the phone. I'm going to step up to the plate. You know, I'm going to take you all out of this.
I'm going to fall. The other 17
can go home. No. So there's some, you know, motive here, just like he did in that that interview about abortion. I mean, he wasn't far off in the sense of, that's an okay idea. Make it, you know, you establish a date, you have this national standard they can talk about. But the conservatives, of course, are, you know, their heads are blowing off. Then he made a couple other statements that's freaking them out. And, you know, one would say, well, they won't go for Biden over Trump. Well, guess what, though? A lot of them may stay home. So he did a lot of things in that interview that I'm just trying to figure out why.
No, but I'm scratching
my legal
head.
You know, the legal part, there's something behind this as to why he made that statement.
And there's part of me that goes, you know, I'm with you on this, but there's also a part of me that goes, no, I think he's just off the beaten path. I think he really believes that he is right. He did nothing wrong. Because he said, I did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. And, you know, it's like when my kids were small, whenever they would repeat themselves, you knew they were lying. Same thing with Trump. Yeah, I did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. And now we're seeing Jeffrey Clark saying that he acted under Trump's direction. Now you got him throwing him under the bus. It just seems like a lot of the rats are jumping ship.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nancy Pelosi was talking about, she said that, you know, he's projecting when he blames other people, and, you know, that he's projecting his own thoughts into, basically, people are avatars for his thoughts. And, you know, he's claiming in that interview that he requested the guard, you know, and of 10,000 that he requested it. And there's no record of that. So I don't know. I mean,
yeah, that must be in the filing cabinet.
You know,
that must be in the filing cabinet with the health care plan that was, you know, fabulous and cheap, and the mm-hmm. order that he declassified everything. It must be in the same filing cabinet.
But if in fact he doesn't have some legal thought behind that statement he made, then his lawyers have to be just going out of their minds.
Yeah. They've got to be going, please shut up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
There you go. Bob, as always, appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. I mean, seriously, the guy, every time he opens his mouth, Exhibit A, Your Honor. We got to be into the triple letters by now. Let's take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to the door. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1830. That was the day that Tom Thumb, the first locomotive built in the U.S., raced a horse on a 9-mile course in Maryland. Here is part of John Latrobe's eyewitness account of that historic race. At first, the gray had the best of it, for his steam would be applied to the greatest advantage on the instant, while the engine had to wait until the rotation of the wheels set the blower to work. the horse was perhaps a quarter of a mile ahead when the safety valve of the engine lifted and the thin blue vapor issuing from it showed an excess of steam. The blower whistled, the steam blew off in vapory clouds. The pace increased, the passengers shouted. The engine gained on the horse. Soon it lapped him. The race was neck and neck. Then the engine passed the horse, but it was not repeated. For just at this time, the band which drove the pulley and blower slipped from the drum. The safety valve ceased to scream, and the engine began to wheeze and pant. The horse gained on the machine and passed it. And although the band was presently replaced, the steam again did its best. The horse was too far ahead to be overtaken and came in the winner of the race. The horse may have won the race that day, but the iron horse would soon revolutionize transportation. The railway industry also played an integral part in labor union history. From the early railroad worker brotherhoods to Eugene V. Debs' American Railway Union to A. Philip Randolph's Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, railroads and the workers who built them and ran them helped to build and strengthen the American labor movement.
I've been working on the railroad all the live long day.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. So it's good news. Going to end today on some good news and an email. The good news, all of the shaming works. I can't believe you said that. Shaming works. Last week we were talking about Drew Barrymore. Going to start her talk show up again. Going to scab, get across the picket line. Going to, you know, stick it to the Writers Guild. And everyone went crazy. You know, we were one of the first people to point it out. We came out and said, look, I'm sorry, Drew. You're a scab. Don't do it. Here's what should happen if you scab. And then she came out with that bizarre video of, you know, I take responsibility and, you know, kind of, you know, yeah, this is all bad, but, you know, I'm the victim in this. Well, evidently, she has now heard us. Yep, she's heard. She said, I have listened to everyone and I am making the decision to pause the show's premiere until the strike is over. I have no words to express my deepest apologies to anyone I have hurt, and of course to our incredible team who works on the show and has made it what it is today. We really tried to find our way forward, and I truly hope for a resolution for the entire industry very soon. Well, this then triggered Jennifer Hudson to do the same with her show, and then... I'm surprised at this. Bill Maher came out and said he will not scab either because of the pressure. The shaming works. And this is the kind of stuff that, you know, I've talked about. As a society, we have to call these people out when they scab and then hold them accountable when they scab. I may now watch the Drew Barrymore show now that I know it exists. And she's not going to scab once the writers go back to work. This is how the working class should be operating. This is solidarity. And making someone like Drew Barrymore, who's worth $100+ million, care about this issue is quite an accomplishment. It means that she was getting no positive reinforcement whatsoever. And it was purely a business decision first, knowing that, hey, if I do this, the Rick Smiths of the world will never, never, and I mean never, watch her show or any of her movies. You are ostracized. You're done, in my view. And as a society, I think we have to think that way again. If you're not with us, you're most certainly on these issues on the wrong side of history. So good on her. I'm not going to apologize for anything I said last week because I meant every word of it. I don't apologize because if I said it, I meant it. But good on her in this moment. Got an email from Lewis I want to finish up today with. He said, in regards to the study you mentioned, it's not surprising for these reasons. And I said, look, college-educated people are more liberal in their economic theories, social safety net, taxation, things like that. He says, A, the working class and poor have been demonized for decades by the right because of their need for the various social safety net programs. All the while, the right uses dog whistle campaigns and arguments to convince a segment of these populations, usually white, I guess, that they don't want to be like the groups of color who shamelessly exploit these programs for their hard-earned tax dollars. And the thing is, and I've said this before, there are more broke white people collecting welfare than there are black people. The numbers are staggering. But the narrative, you know, the Reagan-era welfare queen narrative doesn't fit the reality. But he's right on this. He also says, B, the strong belief in the capitalist, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And he points out, look, for the majority of people, the best that they're going to do in a lifetime is to go one socioeconomic rung upward. Sadly, most people are stagnant and a good number declining in this day and age. And the reality is, the rags to riches story, the guy who hits it big, there may be one, two, but for the vast majority, they're going to struggle. So why not? Here's an idea. Make things better for everyone, even the guy who makes it big. Appreciate the email, Lewis. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. That's how you get a hold of me. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.